Heltzeter's own Barbara Glickstein recently moderated a frank discussion on end-of-life issues. Like it or not, death is something we all face, but something that many of us still avoid talking about. So she used a little humor to help break the ice.
The New Yorker's Daily Shouts column is a humor column, and Bess is still alive. She wrote this and titled it, "Obituaries My Mother Wrote for Me While I Was Living in San Francisco in My Early 20s. Let me share a few more of my recent Google alerts with you. We now have living funerals where participants are asked to grapple with their own mortality over dinner. Board games to spark participants to share their end-of-life wishes. Death cafes, a death simulator that lets you experience what cremation is like and rebirth if you'd like. Well, I wanted to show you that in one corner of the ethos about death, people are doing things and saying things and talking about death in ways that we never have seen before. And in the health professional field, we are as well. But maybe not as frequently and as not as forthcomingly, or maybe creatively as they are. So I'm suggesting that it won't be long before more of these alerts become common to our culture around death. We in healthcare too often are trying to pedal as fast as we can to catch up. I'm suggesting we better start pedaling faster.
Then it was time to focus on the very real issues of how people choose to live at the end of life and how they choose to die. What would you do?
5.5 years ago, though, everything changed. I became one of the people who receives palliative care. I'm terminally ill. I have stage 4 cancer. I may not look like I have stage 4 cancer. And people who know me know that I don't act like I have stage 4 cancer. I have way too much fun. But we're talking today about dying in America. And for me, what I really want to talk about is how do you live well until the end? How do you live well with serious illness? 5.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with something called inflammatory breast cancer. It's a kind of cancer that's not a lump or a bump, and you don't catch it early by feeling it on a breast self-exam. It floats in the body. And unfortunately, when it kind of aggregates or kind of blocks up the system, it appears on the skin, and it looks like a little red spot, a funny red spot. And that funny red spot appeared, and I immediately went to go seek care. And I found out exactly what it was. Well, the next thing they did was they did a scan to see how far the cancer had gone. And I felt great. I would have guaranteed you that I had caught it at the earliest possible moment. This cancer is typically caught at stage 3 or stage 4, so spread far or spread very far. But I thought, I'm going to be the one who caught it at the earliest possible point and everything is going to be okay. I really was convinced of that. I felt great. When they did the scan, they found that the cancer, in fact, was in my lower spine. That is stage 4, spread far. The prognosis, the likely course of the disease, is 11 to 20% survive to 5 years. 11 to 20% survive 5 years. People don't survive 5 years. That's what the statistic means. It is highly, highly unlikely. So I'm talking to you, smiling, working, playing, having fun, 5.5 years in.
That's Amy Berman. She's a registered nurse and senior program officer with the John A. Hartford Foundation. Amy's choosing to live her life to the fullest, with minimal interruption, on her terms.
Let me tell you about why my outcome has been a good outcome. And it's the kind of care that most people don't get. It's the kind of care that most people don't ask for. And it's the kind of thing that just doesn't naturally happen. And we need to make sure that it does happen. It is what the evidence says. We all support the evidence, right? We want evidence-based care. I live an evidence-based life. The care that I receive is the care that one would think you should choose, and yet it's not the care that people get. I went to two very different doctors, one that wanted to throw everything at the cancer, intense chemotherapy, mastectomy, radiation, and more intense chemotherapy. Even though it wasn't going to change the outcome, that was what the person wanted to do. Fight, fight, fight. That's the words that he used. And I said, well, if the cancer has already spread from here to here, and in fact is floating around in my entire body, why do you want to do a mastectomy? It's not going to get rid of the cancer. And he said, this is the treatment that I do for all of my patients. And trust me, I believe him. My oncologist here in New York City said, why don't we focus on what's important to you? Knowing that we're not going to cure the cancer, because there is no evidence that there is a cure for this cancer. So knowing that it's not going to be curative, why don't we do the treatments that have the least amount of side effects? Why don't we focus on helping you feel good? She asked me what was important to me, and I told her I wanted the Niagara Falls trajectory. Do you want to know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. I start up here feeling really good, because that's how I felt, and I still feel. I want to go good, 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 and drop off the cliff. You know, make the good time as good as possible, minimize the bad time. And the other doctor, that one that wanted to do everything, wanted to drop me off the cliff and take me out to the same endpoint. So I don't have a choice about the destination, but I do have a choice about the route I take. And I want Niagara Falls. Because if you focus on quality, all of the evidence suggests you live longer.
Amy took control of her illness and found a practitioner who honors her decisions. It's not always easy. The majority of Americans still die in hospitals, where achieving similar goals is more challenging. Dr. Kenneth Prager is Director of Clinical Ethics and chairs the Medical Ethics Committee at Columbia University Medical Center.
I think everybody's goal in terms of how does one want to die, everybody wants a peaceful and dignified death, if possible, at home, right? Absolutely. And I think everybody would like to die the way Jacob died in the Bible. If you look in Genesis, Jacob is surrounded at the age of 147 by his 12 sons and by his one daughter, Dinah. And he gives a blessing to all of his sons. Some are better blessings, some are not so hot. And then at the end of his blessings, it says, when Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. I'd like to die like that. And I think you probably would as well. I don't have 12 sons, but even so, that's what we want. So that's everybody's goal. That's everybody's goal. That's a no-brainer. Nobody wants to die a lingering death in the ICU, spending days, weeks, and sometimes months, hooked to machines, unconscious, suffering, and then finally dying. So I think these are both no-brainers. We know how we want to die, we know how we don't want to die. However, it's not so simple. The Niagara Falls analogy is what we all want, but it always doesn't work out that way. Why is that? What are the obstacles to dying the way Jacob did? I think there are a number of obstacles. Number one, medical technology. Medical technology offers people the hope of prolonging not only the quantity, but the quality of life, even when they're quite sick and when they're quite old. And the more sophisticated our technology gets, the less clear it is when the tip comes when you're about to go over the falls.
Then there's that more ambiguous aspect called hope.
There are people who really hold on to the hope and love life to the very end. And if the doctor gives them a 20% reasonable chance of recovering from an pneumonia at the age of 85 going on a ventilator, there's an awful lot of people that will grasp at that. And sometimes it doesn't work out, and so their desire to have a peaceful death like Jacob doesn't work out because they hoped and it was a reasonable offer to them. It wasn't unreasonable. Another obstacle not to have a beautiful death is when people haven't discussed it, and we don't know what people's objectives are. Some people want to talk about death. Some people are very forthright, the way Amy Berman is, and other people are allergic to talking about death. They get hives when they just think about it. And if they haven't really spoken to their family and haven't said what their wishes are, how are we going to guarantee that peaceful death if we don't know what they want?
And of course, family dynamics come into play.
If you have 12 sons and 12 daughters, you may have 12 different opinions about what mom and dad would like and how they would like to live and how they would like to die and whether it's good to keep them on the respirator because there's a small chance and whether it's not good. So families can be very difficult. There can be conflicts, all well-meaning, but nevertheless, that's another obstacle to a peaceful death. And lastly, the role of physicians. And I say over here, all I can tell you is in my experience of thousands of consults over 20 years at Columbia, it has been the families far, far more than the doctors who have been pushing to keep somebody desperately ill alive against all chance of getting better. It's been the families. It hasn't been the doctors.
Of course, there are dozens of ethical issues with end-of-life care, and they'll only become more prevalent.
On the one hand, we have people and families who don't want to die no matter what, medical futility, they will die in the hospital no matter what, but there is no question of withholding or withdrawing life support. A horrible death, not our fault. Families simply cannot let go very often, and sometimes patients can. And the other extreme is when people who are awake and alert say, I've just learned that I have Alzheimer's disease, I want you, Dr. Prager, to turn off my pacemaker. That's an ethical issue. Do I do that? Is that euthanasia, etc.? And then there's everything in between. We'll probably have some more of these discussions in the coming years because there's a perfect storm. The perfect storm is we have a whole tidal wave of baby boomers who just reached 70 years of age this year. We're going to have a tidal wave of old people in the next couple of decades, and couple that with our increasingly sophisticated medical technology, and you ain't seen nothing yet.
But what happens when the patient is incapacitated? Should their previously communicated wishes still be honored? Dr. Judith Schwartz is with End of Life Choices, New York.
People call us wanting to know how can they get the information they need in order to be able to make informed choices that reflect their values and wishes. And I, as the clinical director, work with patients and their families and explore with them their concerns, their fears, their values, and their wishes. The goal being to help them make choices that reflect their values and wishes. And often that involves coaching patients and families about the kinds of questions to ask their physician so that they will get the information they need from their physicians and get the kind of support that they want and that physicians want to provide. So that, again, patients get to make choices that reflect their values and wishes.
Schwartz is a nurse advocate for Aid in Dying. She says one of the biggest challenges lately is dealing with people suffering from dementia.
You know that healthcare agents must know the wishes of their incapacitated or the patient, their wishes about artificial nutrition and hydration, right? And the good thing about that is we're seeing fewer and fewer feeding tubes being put in people with dementia, which is a really good thing. However, nobody thought to consider or have a conversation about whether they would want to continue to be fed by hand in the event that they lose decision-making capacity and the ability to feed themselves. And that's what we're now having conversations about. We're suggesting to people that when they complete an advance directive, this is one of the things that they can do to stay in control of their own dying, even though they have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So when people call us and say, what can we do? What can we do? We want to talk to you. We want to talk with our family members. We get together, and often in the patient's home, we sit down. It's a very extended conversation. It occurs over many days. There are some people for whom the thought of Alzheimer's for them is a fate worse than death. The notion of losing all control of their lives, their cognition, their ability to take care of themselves is just horrific. So they want to know what they can do. And what I say to them and their family members or their close friends is that there are two options. And one of them is, again, to complete this very comprehensive written document that states their understanding of their diagnosis of Alzheimer's, their prognosis, their desire to not be hand-fed in the event that they both lose the ability to feed themselves and they lose decision-making capacity. They have to have support from their family. They have to have support from their physician, who will also attest to the fact that they at this point have decision-making capacity and that they understand the decision that they're making and the consequences of that decision, which is to hasten death.
Getting people comfortable talking about their wishes is a real dilemma, even for those who deal with these issues every day. Carolyn Jones is a filmmaker. Her most recent documentary project focuses on hospice and palliative care. She says that even getting her own parents to talk POLST, physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, took a huge effort.
So I'm sitting there with my father, who I love madly, and I'm saying, so, Dad, it's like this. You have this feeding tube, and you can't, I mean, you know, I was going through all these scenarios. And it was really, really difficult, and it really brought home all that is at stake here with end-of-life conversation.
And with support from the Jonas Foundation, she started talking to nurses about end-of-life issues.
We started shooting, and everything was blown to smithereens for a lot of the reasons that we talked about here on this stage tonight. I started off making a film called Dying in America. I thought that's what it was going to be. And I thought that it's our responsibility as American citizens, because we're headed towards a tsunami of sorts, because this can't continue, right? I mean, we spend entirely too much money. The technology is so complex. How are we going to figure this out? And don't we as citizens need to get to a point where we embrace the end with some graciousness? Are we not becoming kind of greedy about life to want to try every last thing that's out there? That's what I started to think. So I thought, that's it. I have to make a manual about how to die. I want to learn how to die. I want my family to learn how to die better. And we can take the audience with us and show how people are doing it. As soon as I saw the complications of what we're actually dealing with at the end of life, everything changed. This one word kept popping up, which was hope. And we've all said it tonight. We've all talked about hope on this stage already. Sometimes it's the villain, and sometimes it's what saves you. It's a weird word to name this film, but at the moment, that's what it's called. We're calling it hope.
That approach fits well with the Jonas Center's mission. In addition to supporting Carolyn's filmmaking, Executive Director Dolores Curley explains why they sponsored the evening's discussion.
The issue of death and dying in America is becoming one that so many more families want to talk about and need to talk about. And the majority of people in America want to die at home, but that's not what's happening. The majority of people are dying in hospitals or facilities. So we want to take this opportunity to bring experts together to really help healthcare providers and families and patients have this important discussion and feel comfortable about it. I think the word of tonight is choice. And that is every patient, every family has a choice at the end of their life about how they want that time to be. And everyone can choose something different. It's also about healing, because as healthcare providers, I'm a nurse, and I know how I have felt working with patients and families at end of life, including pediatrics to geriatrics. But also, we have to deal with it in our family, and we all have that journey together. You know, as a philanthropic organization, we want to improve healthcare through the professions. And so we are champions. Barbara and Donald Jonas are philanthropists. They took their own money and they are supporting nursing and medical Innovation and many other projects, and they are champions for these new ideas. And Carolyn Jones, again, she's a champion telling the story. And so we have many different voices to reach people to discuss important healthcare issues. And so philanthropy is a spark. It's the fuel to get ideas to more of an audience.
Several audience members shared their own unique stories, and many wanted to know why nurses, doctors, and other health professionals weren't getting more training in end-of-life issues, starting in school. Judith Schwartz and Ken Prager.
Many of us in the room have taught nursing students at one time or another about end-of-life issues. And many, many faculty think it's good to have a nursing student complete an advanced directive. I never thought that was such a great idea, frankly. But what I did think was a wonderful tool was to have those students help somebody in their family complete an advanced directive. And when I worked in the city university system, there was the UN in front of my, where I was teaching. So these students came back with these extraordinary stories of how difficult it was with their Chinese-speaking grandparents who had no idea what this was about and how they really had to struggle with it over time. And I asked them to write about it. It was the most profound teaching experience I had. I just thought it was fabulous.
I don't think enough is happening. I think it's very institution dependent. Frankly, I think at Columbia we could be doing more. It's a very scientific oriented curriculum, and I think the students at Columbia should be getting more in the way of end of life discussions, education, and so forth. I think it's a matter of time. Overall, I'm very optimistic, though. I think the country is going in the right direction. I also think that the baby boomers are more sophisticated. They know about internet, and they're going to make their wishes known more than the prior generations.
Schwartz later told me that with cases like Brittany Maynard's getting national media attention, the chances that more states will consider aid in dying laws are pretty good.
I think that you're going to see more and more states try to take it up. It takes a great deal of effort and money and resources to be successful, and there are some states that are just very, very conservative, like New York, for example. This is a scary prospect for many people, particularly people who have very strong religious values, and sadly, they think that their values are mainstream or ought to be, and nobody else should have an option that they don't think is morally or ethically appropriate. But I still think, because there's so much information out there in a way that it never was before, these kinds of stories like Brittany Maynard, who made it part of her business to tell the world about the comfort she got from knowing that she could, when she chose, if she chose, hasten her own death, was an amazing story. Now, whether it'll happen in New York, it's very, very hard to say.
In the meantime, what can be done to lessen the stigma of talking about death and dying?
So I just want people to remember that without having the conversation like my providers have had with me, and like we know is the right thing to do, we can't make the right choices. I've made the right choices for me, and fortunately, I'm only an N of one. But you get to see the outcomes.
Having the conversation, a seemingly simple task that's incredibly complex. But it's one panelist say that must take place, preferably sooner rather than later. For HealthCetera, this is Liz Siegert.